This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading from the book published in 2022, Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, illustrations by his wife Terry Dalton. She captures the essence of everything that he's describing. Published by the Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. I can't imagine being married to this guy. He had an adventurous childhood on a farm in Iowa, all kinds of skunks and foxes and raccoons as pets, wandered all over the countryside having adventures. Kind of like the rest of his life and career have been the same. And I'm reading a chapter called The Scent of Skunks. Mark Twain is quoted at the beginning, "A boy who picks up a cat by the tail learns a lesson in life that can be taught in no other way." Like so many crazy time-consuming things that happened, the call came at the end of the day on a Friday. When I picked up the receiver, I heard a woman's voice. "My husband told me to call you, and we have a skunk in the basement." "In the basement? How did it get there?" "If it's a walkout basement, just open the door and it will eventually find its way out." "It's not a walkout basement," she said tersely. "And as to how it got there, you'll have to talk to my husband about that." As I got my gear together, I pondered the call. Why is it always the wife who calls with the bad news, I wondered. In my disgruntled state of mind, I speculated that it might be because men are usually too embarrassed to ask for help, and especially if the help has to be sought from the government, let alone the DNR. Coming from Iowa, where the public loved our Natural Resources Agency, I'd been shocked by the attitude I'd encountered in Wisconsin, succinctly summed up in bumper stickers, DNR, do nothing right, DNR, damn near Russia. The Wisconsin DNR is too big, or so the complaints went, they regulate too harshly. They won't let me do what I want with my land or my lake shore, and I pay high taxes. I should be able to do what I want with my land. After all, I own it. We don't need so much government. And yet, who do they call when they need help? My truck was parked outside, loaded with a tent, sleeping bags, and a cooler full of ice and frosty beers. This was not just any Friday. Tonight was the opening of the 4th annual Great Northern Bluegrass Festival in Mole Lake, where I was planning to spend the weekend. Headlining were names like Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass music, and also appearing were Earl Scruggs and other big names like John Hartford and Benny Martin. In an hour, I was supposed to meet a very nice, dark-haired, blue-eyed gal named Anna, who claimed she could dance me into the ground. I had to work fast if I was going to solve the skunk problem and make my date. I got some bait out of the freezer, grabbed a cage trap, flashlight, and a gunny sack, then loaded the truck and drove to the complaint site. "How did you get a skunk in your basement?" I asked the husband when he met me at the side of the driveway. He said, "Come over here and I'll show you." We walked to the back of the house, and there in the corner of the basement window was a softball-sized hole. "The kids hit a baseball last week and it broke the window. I haven't had time to fix it yet." It appeared that the skunk had somehow stuck its head in, sniffed around, and fallen in, dropping 8 feet to the basement floor. "How do you know he's in there?" I asked. "We got a whiff of his smell from upstairs. I turned a light on and saw him scamper under some shelves. He's down there all right." "Is there any way out?" I asked. "Just up the steps, through the living room, and out the kitchen door." "What are we going to do?" A hint of anxiety crept into his voice. "If he sprays down there, we'll have to move out. I've got a wife and 3 kids. We have no place to go." "Well," I said, "here's what we're going to do. I have this cage trap. Skunks are easy to catch in these traps, and they're not too smart. I'm going to bait this trap with some tasty morsels. Then I'm going to wrap the trap in this gunny sack so only the door is exposed, and carefully, quietly, walk down those basement steps with the trap and place it on the floor in full view of the top of the steps so you can check it from upstairs. When the skunk gets caught, you'll see that the trap door is down. I'm going out of town for the weekend, so when the skunk is caught, just quietly walk down the steps, slowly pick up the trap, and carefully walk up the stairs through the house and out the door. Just so you know, it's illegal to release a live skunk in Wisconsin, so once you catch the skunk, you can dunk the skunk and trap in the lake or gas the animal under your car exhaust pipe. Oh, and one more thing. See this handle? It's in the middle of the top of the trap. You'll need to feel through the burlap sack and make sure you have a good grip on the handle. Don't drop it. If you do, the skunk could spray. Oh, and one more thing. Sometimes they chew up the gunny sack from the inside of the trap, scratch it up, and chew holes in it. You don't want the skunk to see you, so get an old rug or another sack, and if you think it's too chewed up, take a broom handle, lay the rug over the handle, and reach out with the handle and place more covering over the trap before you pick it up. Okay, you got it? He looked at me, his wife standing behind him, listening, three kids huddled around her legs. No way, he said. That's crazy. I'm not going down there. If that skunk sprays, we're finished. This is your job. You get paid to do it. Skunks can carry rabies. I'm not going near it. My heart sank, but I thought a minute. My boss, John Olson, was out of town for the weekend, and our student intern was gone as well. I considered asking the fire control crew to help out, but discarded that idea. They would not appreciate the request. Then I thought of the game warden, weighing up the number of times I had assisted him and whether I could push for a favor. No, I thought, not for a skunk. In the ranger station, work hierarchy asking for help on skunk control was really pushing the limit. I looked at my watch. Anna had left Hurley by now and would be in Mercer in half an hour. What would I tell her? I'm sorry, I can't go this year. I have to catch a skunk and can't leave it in a trap in a basement all weekend. I started down the basement steps very slowly, trap in one hand and flashlight in the other. When I reached the bottom, I carefully placed the trap in the middle of the room, adjusting the burlap and checking to make sure nothing was interfering with the trap's door mechanism. I was ready to head up the stairs when I heard a sound, a slight scuffling of feet near some upright garbage cans. I straightened up slowly and sized up the three long steps to the cans. I thought, why not take a look and quietly ease toward the cans? When I was close enough to see the dark void between the cans, I flipped on my flashlight, and there he was, right below me, between the cans with his head peering forward. I switched off the light. He didn't appear to know I was there. I recalled my neighbor back in Iowa, Don Yanda, the expert skunk descenter who gave me my pet skunk Flower. At one point, he told me that if you grab a skunk by the tail and lift it up off the ground, it can't spray you because a skunk has to have its back legs firmly on the ground to squeeze the sphincter muscle that shoots out the spray. Could I just make a grab and lift this skunk out from between those cans, I wondered? What if I missed or dropped it and it sprayed the basement? Anna, meanwhile, was probably just now pulling into Mercer. She was not going to be happy if I had to cancel. I gritted my teeth, envisioned the motion, then reached down, made the swipe, and grabbed that skunk by the tail, yanking it up and out from between those cans. I swung it around, took three steps, and headed up that stairway, yelling, "Open the door and clear the way!" The basement door flew open, kids scattered, and I walked through the living room, hand outstretched. I continued through the kitchen and out the door, with that skunk bobbing from side to side and his little feet spinning and trying to catch something he could push against. The family followed at a safe distance, and as soon as I got far enough away from the house, I gave that skunk an underhanded softball-type pitch across the yard. He bounced twice and then scuttled into the woods without even stopping to raise his tail. The family stood there staring at me with their eyes wide. No one said a word. I said, "I'll be back for the trap Monday. Oh, and I'd fix that window real soon if I were you." I jumped in my truck and drove away with a grin and high hopes for the weekend. Sunday night, when we got back to Mercer, Anna was curled up asleep against the passenger door. She'd been asleep for over an hour, and while I was tired, too, she had not danced me into the ground. With a full moon overhead, I had danced her into the ground. On Monday morning, I drove back to retrieve my trap from the homeowners. The cage was sitting on the sidewalk by the front door with the burlap bag neatly folded beside it. I looked over at the basement window and could see the glint of shiny new glass. Now we're going to skip forward and go to another part of this chapter called Dangerous Dan. Dan, who was not dangerous, got his moniker on a canoe trip in the Yukon Territory, where, modifying a name from a Robert Service poem, we dubbed him Dangerous Dan the Yukon Man. He was actually from Iowa and had grown up on the farm next to ours. My dad and mom sold a house to Dan's parents when our family bought a neighbor's 80-acre farm. We just wanted the land, so we sold the house and a few acres. I remember overhearing the discussion my parents had with the real estate agent. He came to our house and said, "I've got two offers, one from the Haskells and one from a lady. The offers are close, but the lady's offer is a little higher, so I recommend you take it." I remember my mother saying we would take the lower offer. My dad objected, asking why we would do such a silly thing. She countered, "To get the two Haskell kids out of the trailer they live in and into a real home." The Haskells were good neighbors. Dan's mom, Carol, drove a school bus, and Dan's dad, Paul, was a mechanic in the road construction business. He was an excellent welder, and when Dad had a machine problem, he would go see Paul. One time I remember the corn picker broke down in the middle of the night. A storm was coming, and Dad was in a hurry to get the grain in the bins before the snow hit. He called Paul about midnight, and in no time, Paul was there, lying under the picker with his cutting torch. He cut out the damaged bearing, they put in a new one, and we were picking again. Dad would try to slip Paul a few bucks for his efforts, but he always resisted taking the money. One day Dan called me in Wisconsin, said he'd bought a new motorcycle. He hoped to ride the 400 miles to Wisconsin and do some walleye fishing with me. He had a four-day weekend open from his construction job, and I said, "Come on up, the fish are biting." Dan arrived on a Friday night, and then the phone started ringing. I suddenly had several bear problems I would have to deal with, so I apologized to Dan. He'd ridden all that distance, and I couldn't take him fishing. Dan asked me if he could ride along, because he wasn't keen about turning around and riding all the way back to Iowa right away. I said, "Sure, jump in." And all weekend, we trapped bears in cornfields. I think we caught five, with Dan helping me tranquilize, ear tag, and translocate them. When Dan left on Monday, he said he had more fun than if he had gone fishing. He also said he'd decided to quit his job and go into wildlife conservation. I said, "Dan, you're crazy. My job is not all peaches and cream. With your union job, you make twice as much money as I do. The state doesn't pay all that well. Besides, you're over 30 years old and without a college education. You can't get anywhere in my profession these days without at least a master's degree." Dan said, "Yeah, I know, but the concrete work is destroying my back." It turned out he hated his job, so we dropped the subject. I remembered a quote my dad had found, "When you find the job you love, you never work another day of your life." Against my advice, Dan quit his job and attended the University of Montana. He got his bachelor's degree in wildlife management and was hired by the U.S. Forest Service on a Canada Lynx project in Montana, followed by another lynx project for the Colorado Division of Wildlife. He also worked on a loon project for the Alaska Division of Fish and Game. One spring, a research colleague, Dr. Mike Meyer, needed some seasonal help on his common loon project. He needed to collect color band data on returning loons and later nesting success, capture, blood collection, and banding. He asked me if I knew anyone qualified who might be available. I thought, well, maybe I could get Dangerous Dan on the crew. Dan was hired and worked three seasons before Mike picked him up as a graduate student. Dan and Mike studied the effects of shoreline restoration on wildlife, and Dan graduated with a master's degree from Michigan Technical University 2 years later. He followed his dream, not my advice. One fall, Dangerous Dan called me and said that his loon fieldwork with Mike was over for the season, and Jim Woodford from the Bureau of Endangered Resources had hired him to go to northern Minnesota to trap American marten. Did I want to come along? He needed a helper. Jim would pay, and all we needed to do was live trap 13 females. American marten were, and as of this writing, Wisconsin's only endangered mammal. Michigan and Minnesota had sustainable populations. In fact, both neighboring states had enough marten that their population model allowed a limited quota harvest trapping season for this valuable fur bearer. Minnesota had agreed to give us 100 marten to translocate to Wisconsin to help our population recover, but we had to travel to Minnesota to trap them. Jim's earlier crew had already caught and released most of the marten, but he wanted a 50-50 sex ratio. Males were much easier to catch than females because females had much smaller home ranges, so when a trap line was laid out, chances were greater that the traps would be in male territories. Jim was short 13 females. Our trap line started in Grand Marais, Minnesota, and ran up the Gunflint Trail through the Superior National Forest along the Boundary Waters Wilderness Canoe Area. Jim had rented a small house for us in Grand Marais. He met us there and showed us the cage traps as well as the holding pens for feeding and watering the marten until they're transferred to Wisconsin. Jim's last words were, "Don't come back until you have 13 females, and good luck." It took us 11 days. American marten were not new to me. This project occurred after I had retired, but about 10 years earlier, my last wildlife boss, Bruce Bacon, and I had been working with a science teacher at the Hurley High School named Diane O'Crongley. She would do about anything to get her science students out in the field and was always calling to ask us what we were doing and whether her students could get involved. Public education was a small part of our position descriptions, but we did all we could. We involved the students in our annual waterfowl nest box survey, where we visited each box and recorded its usage and replaced the nest material. They learned the difference between wood ducks, hooded mergansers, tree swallows, and other wildlife box users. But Diane wanted a longer-term, more hands-on project to inspire her class. We came up with a fur bearer habitat research project, at first focused on Fisher and later shifting to American marten. The Iron County Forest, proposed as the project area, is over 170,000 acres, one of the largest county forests in the state. The County Forestry Department received 5 cents per acre from the state to do forest wildlife habitat projects. We generally used that money to build grassy wildlife openings, seed logging trails, plant oak trees, and conduct other wildlife habitat projects. The money could also be used for science-based outdoor education. Our initial idea was to catch a fisher, a member of the weasel family about the size of a large house cat, near each of the county's two school districts, Mercer and Hurley. We would involve the high school science students in the capture and radio collaring of fisher, as well as monitoring their movements using telemetry and tracking them in the field. The teams of students would develop a research hypothesis each year, do weekly field trips, write a report, and give a presentation on their findings. They would learn science, math, public speaking, and writing skills, as well as forestry management, tree identification, habitat typing, and orienteering using compasses and GPS. The program was well received by the county board and the communities. The kids did all the work, and the project was sponsored through the North Lakeland Discovery Center, an environmental education center that served both communities. After about 5 years of fisher study, Bruce found and documented a small population of marten in the middle of the county forest. He decided we should switch from fisher to marten because their endangered status would mean the data on this population would be very useful to the DNR. I thought it was a bad idea. What if we don't catch any? After all, they're rare. But I was wrong. Within 1 week, they had caught two marten and radio collared them. The project is still active today, and as of 2016, they had captured 16 marten in 9 years. The program is now sponsored by Iron County Land and Water Conservation Department in cooperation with the DNR, Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and Purdue University. The students have won 2 Science Achievement Awards, including a $70,000 Samsung Award for computer technology, and some of the students have gone on to pursue careers in natural resources. During all of this Fisher and Martin science research, I'd stayed actively involved. The first coordinator of the Fisher portion of the project was Terry Dalton, my girlfriend and later wife. She had a master's degree in environmental education and coordinated the trapping and telemetry work for the first 4 years. Terry's sister, Diane, worked for the Iron County Conservation Department and helped launch the program. The last year of Fisher and following years of Martin were coordinated by Zach Wilson, who has a degree in outdoor education and works for the Iron County, and, oh yes, he happens to be my son. Between family and associates, I'd been part of many Fisher and Martin captures, had done or assisted with much of the drugging and telemetry work, and now here I was working in northern Minnesota with Dan. Our trap line in Minnesota was in some beautiful country. We saw moose tracks every day and actually encountered 2 wolves, as well as seeing numerous wolf tracks. We had good tracking snow and found good marten trapping locations. The best habitat for capture locations was an old-growth forest with a lot of coarse woody debris on the ground. Marten are modest-sized members of the weasel family and are about as big as a fox squirrel. They feed mostly on mice and voles, but will take a chipmunk or red squirrel occasionally, preferring habitat with thick ground cover, not only for the mouse habitat, but as protective cover from predators such as fisher, great horned owls, and goshawks. Our trap line consisted of 30 live catch cage traps dispersed over about 50 miles. We caught marten every day, but mostly males. The females were few and far between, and in the end we caught 34 marten in order to get those 13 females. One problem we encountered was determining the sex of the marten without taking a lot of time in our trap line check. Females are smaller, but it was hard to tell a yearling male from an adult female. In mid-September, their fur was getting thick and longer as they began to prime up for winter. We'd hold the cage traps over our heads and try and look at their genitals from below to determine their sex, but it was very difficult to get a certain conclusion on the sex of the animal. We had a drug for tranquilizing, but it took a lot of our time to drug an animal, and if we were wrong on a male, we'd have to use more time waiting for its recovery before releasing it and continuing down the trap line. Besides, a marten in a trap is pretty lively, and it's quite a challenge to drug one. The best technique is to hook its tail with a stiff wire hook without getting bitten through the cage, then grab the tail with your hand and pull the tail outside the cage. This pulls the marten's hip against the cage. As you hold it there, your assistant injects the needle into its hip and pushes the plunger, delivering the drug. Yes, it's as difficult as it sounds. Then I had an idea. Why not bag them without the drug? The next morning, I stopped at the local gamble store in downtown Grand Marais and purchased a cloth mesh gym bag. It had a drawstring, like on a sleeping stuff sack cover. It was about the same size. We tested my new idea on the next marten we caught, slipping the bag over the end of the trap and tightened the drawstring. Dan then opened the trap door and the marten ran into the bag. When the marten hit the end of the bag, I grabbed the bag with gloved hands and squeezed it shut in the middle. Dan then released the drawstring, removing the bag from the end of the trap, and we had our bagged marten. I lifted the bag and with both gloved hands, slid my hand down the bag until the marten was tightly compressed at the bottom. Next, I clasped my thumb and index finger around its neck so it couldn't bite me. Dan then peeled back the bag, exposing its genitals so we could determine its sex. From then on, we used this method. If it was a male, we released it with a gentle toss. I had to use the toss because if I didn't, they'd bite me every time. In fact, marten are so fast that one time I gave one a toss and it turned in midair, bit me, then let go and landed in a tree. If the marten was a female, I simply kept a gentle grip on the animal while Dan loaded a syringe with the drug and carefully injected the needle. We then took the standard measurements of the animal, put its radio collar on, and put it in a holding cage for transport to Wisconsin. We got so good at bagging marten that we did all of them that way, even the ones we knew were female. Today, Wisconsin has an estimated population of around 1,000 American marten spread across the state. I like to think that our small project contributed to the larger efforts of the state and federal agencies like Great Lakes, Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and U.S. Forest Service, who are working to recover this endangered species in Wisconsin's North Woods. And I will end there. I'm reading Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology. Dave Creer suggested this wonderful book to me. It's written by Jeff Wilson, published in 2022 by Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.